The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freiber.
Hello.
In a cafe there in Mallorca, Daniel?
Just killing time between training camps. I'm doing a bit of a training camp crawl, if such a thing exists, this week. Today's an off day.
A morning cappuccino?
No. Just had a bocadillo, a sandwich.
Happy International Mountain Day to you.
Oh, thank you very much, Rich. I did some vertical cycling this morning, actually. Funny you should mention that.
And we're also joined by Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Lionel. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah. Very good.
Not anywhere exotic like Daniel?
No, definitely not. I haven't really been anywhere exotic for a while, but looking forward to an exotic trip in January. Not that exotic, but outside the UK.
Exotic enough. Now, Lionel, you're going to give us a news roundup in a moment, but the bulk of this episode will actually be taken up with a trip that Daniel has just made to the Bora Hansgrohe team camp in Mallorca. We're going to hear a very, very interesting interview with Sam Bennett and also with Peter Kenyuk. So that's the bulk of this week's episode. We've been caught in the hop a little bit because a big story has broken just as we record, and that is that Team Sky will cease to exist at the end of 2019. Sky are pulling out as the sponsor of the team. It'll be their 10th year in the peloton. That's obviously big, big news. We didn't feel like we could cover that properly this week. We're gonna cover it in next week's episode in depth and with some interviews. So there'll be the definitive story on Team Sky and Sky's withdrawal from cycling coming at the start of next week. This week's episode is mainly taken up with Daniel's very interesting trip to Bora Hansgrohe. But Lionel, that will feature in your news roundup, no doubt. What else is there?
Well, the Tour de Yorkshire 2019 routes have been announced. 4-day stage race for men from May the 2nd to the 5th, and 2 days for the women on the 3rd and the 4th. One good thing is that it's not clashing with the Giro d'Italia this time, as it did this year. Likely to be a very strong field, both for the men and the women's races, not least because there'll be an opportunity for everyone to go to Yorkshire and check out the World Championship courses. The stages are Doncaster to Selby, Barnsley to Beedale, which will be the first of the women's stages as well, Bridlington to Scarborough, which is the other women's stage, and then Halifax to Leeds. Big year for cycling in Yorkshire. We might even make that, as it doesn't clash with the Giro.
Hope so.
Why not? Well, Daniel's trip to Bora Hansgrohe threw up some stories, one of which is that Peter Sagan, the former world champion, will apparently continue his classic season until Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Richard, we were talking before we recorded that this makes perfect sense, seeing as the finish of Liège-Bastogne-Liège is due to change. He's never ridden it before. He has ridden Flèche-Wallonne once, finished 12th in 2013, but maybe Sagan can add one of the Ardennes classics to, Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders. We shall wait and see. A story that's brewing and the consequences of which will come out in the wash, I'm sure, is Jess Varnish is currently having a case heard at an employment tribunal in Manchester. She's seeking to establish that she was employed by British Cycling or UK Sport in order to then pursue a case of discrimination. She was a silver medalist at the World Championships in 2011. She won Commonwealth bronzes in 2014, but she was dropped by British Cycling in 2016 and not picked for the Rio Olympics. She's alleged she's been a victim of discrimination and claimed that there was a culture of bullying at British Cycling, which led to Shane Sutton leaving as technical director. But this case is going to be really interesting because it could have far-reaching ramifications for the way that British Cycling and other Olympic sports select and fund their athletes, because at the moment, riders like Varnish are awarded what are essentially tax-free grants rather than salary. And if that were to change and Varnish were to win this case and establish in the first instance that she was an employee, it could mean, well, for one thing, that riders would have to pay tax and national insurance, and it would change the whole funding model. But we will wait and see. Speculation on that at this point, but that case is certainly one to keep an eye on in the coming weeks and months. Talking of track cycling, the London Track World Cup kicks off at the weekend, Friday to Sunday. It is in the London Velodrome. 5 British Olympic champions in action, including Laura and Jason Kenny and Katie Archibald. If you want to watch that, that will be on the BBC, on TV and online. Eric Szabo, the multiple green jersey winner at the Tour de France, ace sprinter of the 90s, he's been hired as Katusha's performance director. Maybe that will help Marcel Kittel get his career back on track after what was, by his standards, a very poor year. Only 2 wins for Kittel this season, both of them at Tirreno Adriatico in March. He was time cut at the Tour de France on the same day as Cavendish at La Rossière. Didn't finish either of his final 2 stage races, the Bink Bank Tour or the Deutschland Tour, and finished his season in August. So looking to get back on track for Katusha. And another a quirky one, Rich, you're an Uber user, aren't you? Lance Armstrong has revealed on in the American media that he invested $100,000 in Uber when it was a small company worth only $3.7 million. And he said that the investment has basically saved his family after all of his legal troubles following the doping case fallout. Made him tens of millions of dollars. He wouldn't be more specific than that, but somewhere between $10 and $50 million.
Could he be the man to save Team Sky?
Goodness me. Goodness me, Rich. I mean, that's like throwing a hand grenade into proceedings, isn't it? But you said there it's the end of Team Sky. And what struck me, and we'll discuss this in more depth next season, is, you know, it's the end of next season. Sorry, next episode. Goodness, getting carried away. But it's not necessarily the death of the team, is it? It's just the sponsoring company is pulling out. But, of course, the sponsoring company is also the owner of the team. So I guess really what they're looking for is a buyer for the World Tour license and the infrastructure and everything that Dave Brailsford has to offer. And because of the level that has been built up to, that is quite a significant purchase price that I would imagine they're going to be looking for. So someone somewhere has got to go and find a company or a series of companies that can plug a big gap.
Well,
the sort of money that Lance Armstrong
Uber,
might have
Team
from
Uber.
His Uber.
Uber for Dave Brailsford. Also, you know, Egan Bernal just signed a 5-year contract worth apparently about £12 million. Garrett Thomas on a new 3-year contract worth about the same. Chris Froome contracted up to the end of 2021. So, you know, these riders also will come as part of that package and their contracts. And so it's a lot of money that they will be looking for, and quite complicated because, as you say, the sponsor owns the team rather than just being a sponsor. They are team owners as well. So a difficult one. I mean, on the one hand, 10 years in pro cycling is quite a long time, probably a bit more than the average for a title sponsorship of a pro team. In a way, Team Sky, that's the natural lifespan.
Were you surprised that this has been announced now, at a time when basically the riders are all getting back together for their pre-Christmas training camp? It all basically starts now, and they're just receiving
day one.
This news yesterday.
Yeah, day
afternoon.
One of the Team Sky camp in Mallorca today. I think it's taken them by surprise, I suppose. It's not a surprise when you think about what's been going on at Sky, the company, who have just been taken over by Comcast, and that's bringing about huge change to Sky, the company. And I think most people would have looked at that and said, I can't really see the team continuing with Comcast rather than, you know, James Murdoch in particular being the driving force behind the team, because James Murdoch has been, since day one, the absolute driver behind that team, and Jeremy Darroch to some extent as well. But James Murdoch has moved on from Sky now, and I think, you know, it could be, I don't know, could James Murdoch pop up with a new company as a potential saviour? That's something that Dave Brailsford has mentioned to me in the past as a possibility if Sky did ever pull out. It remains to be seen, but I think the most significant thing of the last few weeks or months has been James Murdoch's departure, and from that point of view it's not a surprise. You know, giving them a year's notice is quite standard as well, isn't it, really, in a way? So in reality that means a few months, however, because Brailsford has said that they want to know what's going to happen in 2020 by the start of the Tour de France next year. It does create lots of very interesting possibilities next year on the road. You know, Team Sky have been renowned for their unity, their willingness to get behind a leader in the Tour in particular. If they go into the Tour next year with, you know, Froome as leader, but Geraint Thomas there, Egan Bernal, and Fiakowski and riders like that, are they going to be as willing to sacrifice everything for a leader of a team that might not be in existence the following year, for whom they might not be riding the following year? I think it's going to be interesting.
That's fascinating. I mean, you know, that you're right. They've been strong and stable, haven't they? Because the team has been so strong and stable. Everyone committed to something that is secure. And all of a sudden, the rug has, in a way, pulled out from under them. And well, we know how it works. Riders will look after their own interests first. Of course they will. If somebody comes along and says to a particular rider, well, we can offer you something absolute. With the team's security being up in the air, you would have to imagine that the riders would, you know, they're not going to be able to hang around and wait forever for Dave Brailsford and co. to put something else in place. But the other thing is, I don't want to make this political at all, but just briefly, because we'll talk about this a lot more next week, but the political and business climate in Britain at the moment is uncertain as well. Will there be British companies willing to invest tens of millions in a team that, you know, predominantly competes across Europe? I mean, yeah, it's not a secure time for any British-based businesses, I would imagine, and it might not be easy finding a sort of Sky-type replacement. It may be that Dave Brailsford and co, or whoever it is that's looking to offload the license, has to cast the net a lot further afield than that and look to look to other markets, maybe, you know, China, South America, perhaps. Maybe that's why Dave Brailsford's been caught in Colombia strongly for a number of months, and, you know, going back to this time last year.
Yeah, and what would that do to the team's identity, which you already feel is shifting? By 2020, Froome and Thomas will be in their mid-30s. You know, who are the young British riders coming through? Tao Geoghegan-Hart probably is the best prospect, but they seem to be investing as much, if not more, in young Colombian riders. So, well, we'll wait and see what happens, Lionel. If anyone's wondering where Daniel's gone, I think he's just topping up his cappuccino, but he'll rejoin us in a moment to tell us all about his day at Bora Hansgrohe. And as we say, we will return to the topic of Team Sky and Sky's withdrawal from cycling in detail next week. We'll have some interviews as well with some of the key players. So that'll be an in-depth episode on Team Sky at the start of next week.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. Now, if you're looking for Christmas gift ideas, there are a lot of them on rafa.cc. Gifts for men and gifts for women. Quite a lot of festive 500-themed gifts. Some very nice, some very natty socks, bottles, caps, or RCC membership. That's the Rafa Cycling Club membership, is a nice gift for somebody for Christmas. I should also draw your attention to an article on rafa.cc about Paul Sherwin, a tribute to Paul Sherwin. Our episode last week was dedicated to Paul Sherwin, who had very sadly died the previous weekend, aged just 62. The ITV co-commentator, of course. We had an interview last week with Phil Liggett, but there's also a nice piece on rafa.cc paying tribute to Paul Sherwin, the writer and co-commentator. While we're on the subject of Christmas gifts, we should also say that our friends scheme for 2019 has opened. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com, and we're offering it as a Christmas gift if you want to sign up for somebody else. The process is, now Lionel, you can correct me here if I get this wrong, but you sign up and then you email us at The Cycling Podcast, that's contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, with instructions about the name of the recipient and so on, and we'll arrange an email for them on Christmas Day. Did I get that right, Lionel?
I think so. I mean, you're saying this as if I'm the one that's running this particular initiative, and that's my understanding of how it's working, yes.
Do you give Christmas presents, Lionel?
Well, it very much depends.
Just friends of the podcast subscriptions, I think.
You're not the podcast resident Scrooge?
No, I love Christmas. I mean, that's no. What do you mean, not anymore? There's lots of things. Lots of things I don't like, but I do like Christmas. I'm very much looking forward to having a long, long stretch of time off. That's
right. I thought you were going to say a long lunch there. A very, very long lunch on Christmas Day.
Well, quite.
I hadn't quite finished plugging our friends scheme for 2019. The first episode is our Giro diaries. That's myself, Lionel, and Daniel Freiba from the Giro this year. We all kept diaries, and we're releasing sort of four audiobooks, aren't we? One about the Giro, one the Tour de France, one the Vuelta, and one the Women's Tour, which Orla Chenoui has done. And contributing to that are us three, plus Francois Thomazeau, and as I mentioned, Orla. So those four episodes count as one special episode for Friends of the Podcast in 2019, and they will all be released over the festive period. The Giro d'Italia diary is out already, available to you to sign up at thiscyclingpodcast.com. And it's £15 again to become a member, a friend of the Cycling Podcast.
Frozen prices, Rich. I mean,
frozen prices.
That's extraordinary.
Austerity.
Well,
the opposite of austerity.
Well, I mean, people do also have the option to pay a bit more if they really like what we do. And on a slightly serious note, a big thank you to everyone who signed up as a friend of the podcast for 2018 or any of the other years. And hopefully people enjoyed this year's episode enough to consider doing so again for 2019. Because, not to put too fine a point on it, that funding directly goes into our coverage. It helps keep us on the road for the three Grand Tours. This year it's helped us do the Women's Tour, give the Women's Tour Grand Tour treatment with daily episodes. We've launched Explore, which we wouldn't have been able to do without having the funds to do so. So hopefully people can see that we are turning Friends of the Podcast money into more coverage of all types of cycling.
Hashtag content. Daniel, you're fresh from Bora Hansgrohe. How were the Bora Hansgrohe gang? Where were they? Are they in the middle of a training camp? How did you find them?
Yes, Rich. So yesterday I was in Palma in Mallorca, and as we said at the start of the episode today, there are a few training camps happening in Mallorca at the moment. It's not as popular a destination as it used to be with leading teams. Denia and Calpe over on the Spanish mainland, south of Valencia, have sort of stolen its thunder a little bit. But there are three World Tour teams here at the moment: Katusha, Bora, and Lotto Soudal, Red Lotto. And yesterday, Bora Hansgrohe had gathered the international press, and it was mainly German press actually, for a press conference. And we didn't know what this was going to be about, but they unveiled, two contract extensions. One with the German national champion Pascal Ackermann, and a second one with Emmanuel Buchmann. Yeah, this sort of signals, it kind of reaffirms the direction that Bora Hansgrohe are trying to go in, to become more and more of a German team, a team that self-identifies as German. They obviously have Peter Sagan as well, but Buchmann and Ackermann are very much front and centre of their plans for the next couple of years. Buchmann is going to target the general classification in the Tour de France next year. He was 12th in the Vuelta, you might remember, at the end of 2018. And Ackermann, who really burst onto the scene with a lot of sprint wins in 2018, he looks increasingly as though he's going to be their main pure sprinter over the next couple of years, and he's going to ride the Giro next year, which is a slightly, it's a slightly contentious decision as far as some people will be concerned, because Bora, of course, have another sprinter, Sam Bennett, who won three stages at the Giro in 2018, but he is now, it looks as though he's not going to do the Giro in 2019.
Well, indeed, Daniel. I mean, Ackermann was, quite a breakthrough year for him. He's 24 years old. He signed up now to the end of 2021, which is, quite a long time. And as you say, a pure sprinter. He's won quite a lot of big races. Hasn't ridden a Grand Tour yet. And he's clearly been groomed by Bora Hansgrohe as, the successor to Eric Zabel or somebody, or Marcel Kittel, or André Greipel. There's such a great tradition of sprinters in Germany. Being on a German team will certainly help him as well. So shall we hear your conversation with Sam Bennett, who's always very, very honest, and this is a very interesting interview.
Rich, we started off the interview with Sam Bennett started off touching on last year or 2018 and what he's learned from that, and particularly some changes he's made to his approach to training. I think you'll hear some quite interesting tidbits about that. But then the interview pivots slightly about halfway through, and it takes on a completely different tone, and you'll hear why.
I suppose I kind of figured out that I shouldn't train like a normal sprinter because I actually have a bigger engine than I thought, so I have to do the big hours. I need the bulk, and I need some hard training. That seemed to work the best for me. I think about 5 or 6 weeks I was doing plus 30 hours, and my body loved it, absorbed it well. So just not to be afraid to push the body. Before I thought that I needed less hours and some intensity, just like not like training like a normal sprinter, but that's not the case with me, because I suppose unlike other sprinters I have a high VO2 max, so I actually, when I'm fit, I should be able to climb really well. I kind of had to change everything, but I really learned how to get the most out of myself and how to really hit a high level. Before, I always felt like I wasn't getting the most out of myself. Yeah, I learned a lot with that. And then also, I had a little dip in the center, which I wasn't happy about, but I think it was natural with how the season went. You know, like at the beginning of the year, as I said just a moment ago, like other years I was playing catch up, and I came from such a low level to such a high level really quick from doing such hard training that of course you're going to have a high peak, but you're going to fall off because it's just not stable. So now my approach is to make a big base and then to kind of float from race to race more and take the recovery as I need it. But it's old school. Like it's funny, sometimes you just have to make things more simple. So doing that now, so hopefully next year I can hit those peaks but be more stable throughout the season. What I kind of discovered was like I was getting to the finish much fresher, and it was funny like I stopped doing the sprint training, and just with the hours and I kind of cut down the sprint training but still did strength and endurance, the sprint just came up with it. I spent all this time trying to build more power and speed, and it came from just doing basic training. And then 2 weeks before a grand tour or whatever, I work on my sprinting, and then I like bring down the volume, but the sprint I could get back in a week or two, but the endurance was something that took more time. So it's funny, like I don't lose my speed or my power by doing more hours, which is kind of weird.
And that's obviously sort of the physiology of it, Sam. What about the kind of mechanics of the sprints themselves? I mean, how much do you think there is to improve based from this year or 2018? I mean, how happy were you with the way you sort of managed the sprints this year?
It's funny. I went from more having a lead out to the final meters to getting delivered within a kilometre and then finding my way. It was the freedom to think on the spot and to go off instinct that worked really well for me. So I think I need to do this more and use my teammates to make the race harder. And we've done that a few times where we really drove the tempo on the climbs, and then I was fresher at the end. And I think that plays to my advantage. I had more energy to use in the final to put myself in position, and I wasn't starting to sprint when I was wrecked. I was like, I had it, you know, I could do it. So it's funny, like whenever I had fitness, I was always there. So only when I didn't have the work done, I was already over my limit by the time the sprint started. So I just have to be fit and be confident in myself that the results will come. Just have confidence in the work that's done.
Last year was a bit of a funny year for sprinters in the sense that, well, a lot of the guys that people thought would dominate didn't, and Viviani dominated. But the sort of hierarchy seems to be quite flat. There seems to be a lot of guys on a similar level. Is that just because, was that always going to happen because of, you know, the way you guys look for small margins now? Or do you think there is a guy who could take a massive leap and become that guy?
it's hard because there's so many races and so many sprinters, and nowadays just so many trains that not everybody can get it right every time. I suppose that's one thing that Viviani does well, is that he always gets in the right position to go from 150. You never see him go earlier or later. That's his moment to go. And
that short 150, yeah,
normally, yeah. Otherwise you can get around him a bit easier, but he's not easy to come around.
So the days of 300 meter sprints, they're gone. So the 250s to 300, that's gone.
The only person I can think of that can do that is Kittel on form, or Groeneveg. Groeneveg is the most powerful sprinter there. Maybe, I don't know about speed, but just out of like torque, just pure power, he can just wind up and nobody can even come around him, I think. The rest of the guys have speed, but he just has this grunt. I think, probably the strongest sprinter. But yeah, I think nowadays everybody's so beatable. Everybody can win. It's just the way it's gone. Like, everybody can train, everybody can eat well. Like, the science is there to do it, and it's a level playing field.
And you can't wing it anymore. As a sprinter, you can't be a little bit undercooked and still in that last kilometer still pull something out.
Yeah, you can. It does happen, but it's a lot easier when you're ready. It depends on who's there as well.
And as far as your program is concerned, obviously you're going to be asked this a lot about the other fast guys in the team, and it seems like Ackermann's going to do the Giro, you might do the Vuelta. I mean, how satisfied, dissatisfied are you with the program?
Got it. I performed really well there. Made my name as one of the biggest sprinters in the world, and I get my last 12 sprints in a row in the Giro, never outside the top three. The consistency was there. I know the race, I know how to win there. I feel like, what did I do wrong?
Yeah. You're not German.
I can't help that. I'm not from a big nation, so yeah, it's not nice.
So how are you going to make sure that doesn't affect your motivation? How are you going to make sure it doesn't affect the way you kind of interact with the team and the management?
Yeah, I just have to keep motivated and take my opportunities when they come. That's all I can do.
When did you find out, Sam, that you wouldn't do the Giro?
I kind of knew. You can see the shift in the team, that it's a German team, German sprinter. Peter also is a big name that for marketing. It's marketing. It's sponsors. It's a business. And it's funny that my legs can't do the talking. It's just there's nothing I can do. But without this team, I wouldn't be the rider I am today. They give me great material, great coaches, great staff. They give me every opportunity to be the best I can be, and there's still some opportunities in the year. And the way cycling is today, it's very hard to get teams. So I'm very grateful for my spot in the team, and for the opportunities that they will give me.
Was there any point at which you thought, you had a conversation with the team that this is beneficial for both of us if we part ways at the end of 2018 or even before?
No, not. We just have to have some discussions to see the direction the team will go. It's hard when you're with a team. This is going to be my sixth season. give them, okay, maybe not give them a nice amount of victories. And I really think I'm coming into my best years. I'm going to start getting some big results. I haven't thought about moving teams.
If I understand, you're going to race quite a lot, like particularly in the first 6 months of the year. If you are brilliant, if you're almost unbeatable in sprints, is there any way that you might make them change their mind, either send you to the Tour or the Giro?
I'll use it to build pressure, but I have to respect the decision of my boss. I'm the rider. He's a guy that pays my wage. They do everything for a reason, and you know, as well, like the way it's so hard to get sponsors now, you have to respect the business side of the team. Ralph does an amazing job with this, how he works with Bohr and Hansgrohe and how they put them together and how they market it, and everything is done for a reason. And in the end, it's not nice for me, but he's created one of the biggest teams in the world, and yeah, if he didn't make the decisions he did, then maybe we wouldn't have the best coaches, we wouldn't have the best bikes, we wouldn't have this, that and the other thing. So I think he does a pretty good job now.
And Ralph said that one, I don't know whether it's a carrot that's been dangled, but something you probably will get the opportunity to do is San Remo, or they think that you're going to do San Remo. How do you feel about that, and how are you going to approach that? With obviously Sagan's never won it, people expect him to win it sooner or later.
I've already started riding the circuit once a week, so I'm looking at it. And
does that mean Cipressa and Poggio? I
want to know every crack in the road. But I think if I can have the same form as Giro, I think I can improve in that form, that it's something I can compete in. I don't know if I can win. I've never been there at the final yet, but I know I can compete at the end. Done it twice, but first time I didn't have condition, and the second time I was sick.
What is likely to be the problem? Is it the Cipressa? Is it the distance? Or it could be anywhere if they decide to make the race hard?
If I'm fit, there won't be any problem. The only problem will be is everybody's under pressure, and crashes happen, mechanicals happen. It's just everything has to go right, unless you're out of this world strong and you can just overcome those problems. But you just have to stay open-minded and take it as it comes. But I think it'll be difficult. There's a lot of strong guys, strong sprinters, and if I have form, I'll be there.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Beer 52. How would you like a free case of craft beer? Not you, Richard, the listeners, because you've already got your case. As a listener to the show, we'd like to thank you for listening with the help of our friends at beer52.com. Just go to beer52.com/cycle to claim a free case. It's the perfect chance to get some special beers in for Christmas. As your case has arrived, has it, Rich? Have you opened any yet?
Of course I have, Lionel. I got stuck straight in. The theme this month is West Country Road Trip. Lots of breweries around Bristol and so on in England. Some very nice IPAs and some smoky darker beers as well. So a real variety, as there is every month. And I must say, it's a very good present as well. A case of Beer 52 beer if you're looking for Christmas presents. But important to stock up, of course, for Christmas. And as Lionel says, as a listener to the Cycling Podcast, you can try a first case for free. Just pay £5.95 postage for 8 incredible craft beers. Ferment Magazine, which tells you all about the beers, and also a snack. There's no minimum commitment. You can take the free case, try the beers, see what you think. If it's not for you, you can pause or cancel at any time. Just visit beer52.com/cycle. That's beer52.com, the word beer, the numbers 52.com/cycle, to claim your free case today. Well, we heard from Sam Bennett there, Daniel, and that was a wonderfully awkward moment in the interview when you asked him about, you know, not being selected for the Giro next year, having ridden so well there this year. And I've mentioned a couple of times how honest Sam Bennett is. You know, he's very thoughtful as well, and I find his answers, his explanation of what kind of sprinter he is and what he's learned about himself, to be absolutely fascinating as well. But when you began asking him about the Giro and about his place in the team, he couldn't help himself but give you an honest answer, which is one of the things we like about him.
I think all the more remarkable, Rich, when you consider the setting. Team training camps in December or January, whenever they take place, tend to be a place where you hear a lot of candy floss and a lot of blandishments about how great the new team is or how great the old team is and how much riders are looking forward to the races on their program and in the following year. And you know, yesterday I was talking to Sam Bennett on a swimming pool terrace outside the hotel. He was surrounded by teammates and members of the Bora Hansgrohe management, and it was a day that was, well, it was an important day for the team and the sponsor, in the sense that they were announcing these contract renewals that are going to be very important for the team's future. And he struck completely different notes, while not sort of going over the line of sort of what is fair and decent. I think he, you know, as you heard there, he fully understands the decision from a marketing, a commercial point of view. And but on the other hand, he can't help but feel very aggrieved.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because if you're running that team, the German identity to that team is very, very important. Commercially and sportingly, Ralf Denk, who runs the team, has built that team up over very many years and has done a really good job, I think, of building a formidable multinational team, but with a very strong German identity. You've got a young sprinter like Pascal Ackermann, who does look very, very promising and capable of winning at the highest level. What do you do with him? Is it fair that he gets the nod over Sam Bennett for this race? I guess the proof will be in the Giro itself.
And Rich, you mentioned there the way Ralf Denk has built this team. I spoke to him yesterday about precisely that and how proud he is of having created a team which has kind of organic sponsors. They're not oligarchs. They're not very rich entrepreneurs who are just doing this as a favour. They're two companies that Bora and Hansgrohe that have come in because of the very attractive proposition that Ralf Denk has been able to offer. And he sort of talked to me about the way they work with the sponsors, and it's almost a day-to-day conversation with the sponsors about how they can offer more value. It's not something that's only discussed, you know, when the contracts are nearing expiry. So I think that the relationship between sponsors and team in that particular organisation is maybe stronger and more intimate than it is at other teams, which probably puts even more pressure on them to favour athletes who are going to have an obvious hook for the sponsors. In this case, it's the hook of their nationality.
Yeah, I think that proves that not all wins are equal, are they? And Sam Bennett, who's been with the team since when they were NetApp Endura and had much more of a slightly British flavour, but also a real sort of international aspect to them. The team has become more German over the last few years, to the point where now it is a German team with a one very big star name. And we've talked about it over the course of this season that Bora Hansgrohe is about more than just Peter Sagan. But somebody like Sam Bennett winning three stages of the Giro, you would assume in kind of the old days of cycling that would earn you an opportunity to move on to the Tour de France and test himself at that level, but it doesn't necessarily follow that that's going to be the case. I mean, he wouldn't be so disappointed about missing the Giro in that interview, if he'd been told, don't worry, you're in line for a place in the Tour de France, he's going to have to scrap for a place in the Tour de France just as hard as everybody else. And of course, at the Tour, Peter Sagan will be the number one when it comes to any stages that are likely to finish in a sprint. So it's a really unfortunate position for Bennett, but what can he do other than what he said he was going to do, which is get his head down and try and get some results whenever he has the opportunity?
I think Napalm, you know, you mentioned Sagan there, and both the sort of gift and the curse with Sagan is that he's effectively like three riders a lot of the time. You know, you send him to a race and he's your sprinter, he's your puncher, and he's your breakaway specialist. And that doesn't leave a lot of space for example, a second sprinter. It just wouldn't make sense to send Sam Bennett to the Tour de France. And, you know, from a sponsor's point of view and from a team manager's point of view, that the beauty, the great value of Sagan is that he does cover all of those roles in any given race, so therefore you can send your other sprinter or one of your other sprinters somewhere else, another World Tour, to another World Tour race. But often, or most of the time, that other World Tour race is a less prestigious one. And you know, from the sponsor's point of view, from Bora Hansgrohe's point of view, it's working out perfectly to have Sam Bennett, because you know, he's going to win a lot of races. He'll win 5 to 10 or even more races this year. But you know, that's not necessarily going to align with his personal ambitions. And yeah, I think there have been opportunities, or there have been discussions or thoughts about him maybe leaving the team, and I think Astana were interested at a certain point, and there are certainly a lot of other World Tour teams without a sprinter, without a good sprinter, that would gladly take him. But yeah, you heard him talk there about the equipment as well, and you know, this is something that's cropping up more and more, and when you talk to sprinters in particular, and I've had conversations with sprinters in the last couple of years where they've really emphasised the importance now of the bike in particular. And you know, without this sounding like an advertorial, because it's not, because I don't know the first thing about bikes really, but I did a quick tally of the bunch sprints won by riders on specialised bikes last year. So that's Quickstep riders and Bora riders, and they won 73 bunch sprints last year between those two teams.
Well, yeah, you didn't have to read too far between the lines of what Mark Cavendish was saying earlier this year about how his equipment couldn't compete with the best in the peloton, and he couldn't compete with Sagan on an even footing, wasn't it? And the implication was,
and that, Viviani, he also mentioned,
yeah, that, exactly, yeah. And the thing that they both have in common, of course, is that they're riding a specialised bike. So yeah, there's definitely something in that.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can still get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. This week's question to the Science and Sport expert, Ben Samuels, comes from Chris Gibbons. Hello all, the podcast is of exceptional quality. I listen to many cycling podcasts and yours is my number one. Thanks, Chris. My question relates to long-term weight loss and control, which I believe is a goal of many people interested in cycling. I know that the current trend in discussions and approaches to weight loss suggests the calories in, calories out theory has limited value over the long term due to homeostasis in the human body. That is to say, human energy expenditure levels can adjust dramatically over time to compensate for calorie deficits. Instead, we are now hearing lots about adjusting one's diet to encourage efficient use of fat for energy production rather than an over-reliance of sugar to do this. These dietary adjustments include reducing sugar and carbohydrate intake and fasting, including low-intensity exercise in a fasted state. What are Science and Sport's thoughts on this shift in focus? Is it a fad, or is the science sound? Big question this week for you, Ben Samuels.
The question of carbohydrate or fat is perhaps one of the most widely debated topics in sports nutrition currently. But recent investigations around the concept of fuel for the work required would suggest this shouldn't be an either-or question, rather a question of how to periodise carbohydrate intake to reap the benefits of both. Carbohydrate restriction before or during exercise can induce cell signalling linked to beneficial endurance adaptations in the muscle, and this may also act as a tool to achieve those desired changes in body composition. However, performance would definitely suffer in those sessions, and therefore it's best to follow those protocols around the low intensity work or recovery type training. When performance is the main focus of a session, so in that we're looking at intervals, the top end speed, power work, climbing, long rides, anything that is real high intensity, then adequate carbohydrate before, during and after the session should be provided. In this way, a periodized approach to carbohydrate intake would see both high carb sessions in the week and low carb sessions, promoting improvements in performance, beneficial training adaptations and desired body outcomes, ultimately making us better on the bike.
Thank you very much to Ben Samuels from Science and Sport, and thanks to Chris Gibbons for the interesting question. If you've got a question for the Science and Sport experts, email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, or you can phone in your question if you like. You'll find our WhatsApp voice memo number on our Twitter biog, so have a look there and leave a voice memo if you'd prefer to do it that way. Now, Daniel, who else did you speak to at Bora Hansgrohe?
I spoke to a couple of other people, but one person I didn't really have a long conversation with was Peter Sagan. But there was a shocking revelation from Peter Sagan yesterday at the Bora Hansgrohe training camp.
Go on.
Do you know what it was? He didn't know who Andre Agassi was. Can you believe that?
My goodness.
He didn't know who...
Yeah,
can you remember?
That.
Can you remember a few months ago we didn't know who Mathieu van der Poel was as well? Almost as shocking as when Chris Froome hadn't heard of Roberto Baggio in our interview with him at the Giro earlier this year.
Or Alexander Kristoff.
Of slightly more interest, I suppose, to our listeners will be Sagan's announcement that he hopes to target, or if not target, then certainly compete in the Ardennes Classics this year. So Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which came as a bit of a surprise to me. He's going to have a slower, more sparing build-up this year, so a more sparing calendar in the spring, stay a little bit fresher when he comes into the Cobble Classics, and then he's going to try to eke out his form and whatever energy he's got left until Liège. So that will be an interesting one to watch. I mean, he's obviously won the World Championships three times on a variety of different courses. Yeah, I had a look at the altitude gain in a typical edition of Liège is around 4,300 meters, and the World Championship Sagan won in Bergen in Norway was 3,300 meters of climbing there, and Amstel Gold, he's finished third there once. I think he finished fourth on another occasion, and that's about 3,600 meters. So we're still some way short of the lumpiness of a Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And the other question, of course, is how can he in the couple of weeks between Paris-Roubaix? It's only 1 week, isn't it, after Paris-Roubaix until Amstel, and then another week to Liège. How can he make the adjustments he needs to? I mean, he's got no time to train really in that fortnight. But to go from the sort of condition he'll be taking into Paris-Roubaix to what he needs to have at Liège is going to be quite a challenge, I would suggest.
I think it makes sense this move, because we might even see a slightly leaner Sagan, maybe, with a view to the Ardennes Classics.
Just on that, Rich, actually, on his weight, I found a quote from after the World Championships in Bergen, and he was asked about his weight, and he was asked about whether he could one day target Liège and Lombardy. And he said, well, I weigh 80 kilos. Don't believe what you read. When people say I read 73 to 74, the lowest I can get is about 78 or 79. How could I possibly win Lombardy or Liège?
Well, it remains to be seen how the changes to the course will alter Liège, and whether it will make it a slightly more... Will it open up a bit to bring more riders into the mix for the finish, and it doesn't finish on a hill, of course, next year. So we could go back, when you think about the 80s, when I think it had a similar finish, you had quite a list of all-rounders who would contest for that, not least Sean Kelly, who was obviously a great all-rounder, but never a climber. And I think Sagan, has gone so close, as you mentioned, Milan San Remo is the gaping hole in his palmarès. He's won the Tour of Flanders, he's won Paris-Roubaix, but Liège-Bastogne-Liège just is a little bit more selective, and it could be a race where there's less left chance as far as he's concerned. It could be, you know, the strongest man on the day wins, and in a lot of bike races, Sagan is the strongest man on the day. Shall we hear another interview from Bora Hansgrohe?
Why? Maybe we should, Rich. Also, well, loosely related to the subject of the Ardennes Classics, but someone who's not going to do the Ardennes Classics, Peter Kenyuk, who signed for Bora Hansgrohe at the start of, well, he started life at Bora Hansgrohe at the beginning of 2018, had some difficulties, fairly well documented difficulties with motivation at the start of 2018, sat out a couple of months of racing, and then came back pretty strongly in the second half of last year, or this year, 2018, won the GP Pino Cerami in Belgium, and did some good rides towards the end of the year. And yeah, I spoke to him yesterday in Mallorca and asked him about his program for 2019 and what he's hoping to work on and improve. This time last year, I don't think things were going as well as they are now. Compare and contrast where you are now in December 2018 to where you were in December 2017.
That's a good question, because I'm probably less fit now and more heavy, because obviously finished China end of October this year, and yeah, I think I've done 5 or 6 rides before this camp, so yeah, the first couple of days I've kind of been taking a bit of a beating from the teammates and then sleeping for the rest of the day. From a mental aspect, I feel really settled in the team, feel like get on with everyone well, we're always having a good laugh, and yeah, I feel like really relaxed and with my approach going into next year. I know I've got a bit of work to do, but who hasn't at the start of December? So I'm actually excited for next year and to get racing again. Like I said before, usually I've done probably 1 month training before this camp. So yeah, I'm usually in a bit better shape than now. But all in all, no complaints really with where I'm at.
Presumably you know roughly what your programme is going to be. Tell us a bit about that.
Firstly, I go home for 8 days after this camp and then fly straight out to San Diego with the family for a month. So going to be training down there with Cal Crutchlow, you know, the MotoGP rider. So,
how did that come about?
Basically, his off season's kind of like now until March, I think, and he has a house out there and he lives out there for that whole period. And when the team said they weren't doing a training camp to allow us to do our own thing or spend more time with the family, I thought, what a great opportunity to. It doesn't come around that often where you have the whole of January free. So I thought it's a good place where they can go and live like a relatively normal life, and I can also train really well. And I know I've got a good group to train with, rather than Gran Canaria where it's kind of like, you know, not much for them to do. So yeah, I just thought it'd be a great experience really. Talked to Cal a bit about it in the past, and trying to persuade Cav to come out as well as we speak. So maybe he will, but I'm not sure. And then, yeah, Mallorca races, I'll start with them. And then Almeria, Murcia, Abu Dhabi, or UAE Tour, it's called now, isn't it? Catalonia, Amstel, Romandy, Dauphiné. And then we'll know, like, about the Tour, or whether it's then similar programme leading up to, hopefully, the Vuelta.
So no flesh in Liège?
No. I did want to do Liège, but I think the team's going to be built around Peter this year, maybe, from what the directors have said. But I don't know 100% for sure. And they also wanted me to focus on Romandy, so... At first, I was a bit like, oh, you know, a bit gutted, because I really wanted to do Liège. But I think, you know, when you get the opportunity to target races like Romandy and the Dauphiné, then you've also just got to maybe sit back and look at your results over the last year or two and think, actually, that's still a great opportunity in itself. So, quite happy with that.
And if there's one area, Pete, where, I mean, obviously you're someone who goes well in short climbs, explosive climbs, you're quick as well, but is there anything, any direction in which you want to sort of develop more this year?
Yeah, for the stage races, like I know it's just the consistency and the recovery. I'm not sure what I need to change or what I need to do. I haven't done a Grand Tour in 2 years, so I don't know if that's impacted a bit. But I remember when you tried to interview me before the stage of the Dauphiné, and I just looked at you and said no, because even riding to the line to sign on, I was like, oh my god, my legs are empty, this is not going to go well. And I just had such a shocker of a day.
I thought you just had the hump.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, yeah, 5 days a week I have the hump. But No, but yeah, I think it's just that basically. I need to get back to, into the Grand Tour business, and I need to work on, yeah, like back-to-back racing in stage races. Yeah, and hopefully I can do that throughout the winter. And yeah, so I'm not having those bad days, I guess.
Daniel, that's quite a coup, because Pete Kenyuk famously said on Twitter, and I think copied us in.
So well, he said to me. He said that
oh, did
to
he
me
say it
well,
to you? Was it?
Yeah.
Oh,
and then
I
aggravated it a little bit with a tweet. That
oh, that's right. Oh,
to.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the Buffalo Wade.
Most unlikely.
He came and confronted me. I remember in Bilbao the next morning. He wasn't happy at all. And you don't want to be confronted by Peter Koenig when he's not happy.
Well, he
tell
made
you.
Among the other shock announcements yesterday, the Andre Agassi shock announcement, the Ardennes Classic shock announcement. Peter Koenig made an even bigger one. He's contemplating one day launching his own podcast, Pete's Podcast.
Why is this just because he refused to speak to all the
know.
Others?
Well, he's relaxed his podcast ban. He didn't really go into great detail about why he'd relaxed his podcast ban, but seems to be very much a convert, in fact.
Well, that's great, because it's good. He's always an interesting chap to hear from, and on his day, a really good rider, isn't he? I mean, he rode extremely well at the World Championships as well, having missed so much of the year, and as he said to you there, there were times in the season where he was really struggling at the Dauphiné.
He mentioned that, Rich, because as you guys know, quite often at the start of races, you'll try to speak to riders. Some of us more than others, Rich, we get the brush off. But I remember that day in the Dauphiné where I tried to speak to him, and he told me in no uncertain terms that he didn't want to talk. Then I looked at the results later that day and saw that he'd abandoned, and you sort of join the dots, or you think, well, okay, maybe he knew straight away. And it was interesting to have that confirmed yesterday, that as soon as he left the bus and got on his bike that morning, he could feel how bad his legs were, and he knew he was going to suffer. And that's something that we don't, as journalists, often we don't consider at the start of a race, that some people are just feeling wretched and they know it's going to be a wretched day and they've no desire to do a wretched interview with a wretched podcast.
But I think the results that he had and the performances in the last few weeks really of the season speak for themselves. I mean, he was right up there in a very, very tough World Championships. He was in the same group as Nairo Quintana, Sam Ooman, George Bennett, Jack Haig, Domenico Pozzovivo. Kenneth finished 16th there in the World Championships in Innsbruck, and we all remember, that brutal, steep climb. He was third in Tre Valli Varesine, the one-day race. Again, no picnic, that. And the talent is clearly there. And maybe what he needs is a race program that suits, is tailor-made for him, rather than having the expectation that, inevitably everything must lead to the Tour de France, and if he doesn't make it, that is then seen as some kind of a failure, because, it doesn't necessarily have
it's
to
also,
be.
It's also interesting there, guys, listening to him talk about his inconsistency and how, well, he acknowledges that and knows better than anyone that he has been slightly inconsistent. And there's always been this slight misconception about Pete Kenyuk. He's one of those guys who, when he's at the front of races and when he's going well, he's very prominent. You see him a lot at the front of the bunch. He looks really good on a bike. He's very stylish. And I think people have seen him at times and not been able to understand why, for example, Team Sky weren't picking him for every Tour de France. And when you spoke to people at Team Sky, it was quite obvious why he hadn't been picked for a certain tour, because there were, out of 10 days, there were three when he just wouldn't have good enough legs to do the job that he'd been assigned on that particular day. And a lot of teams now have these rotation systems whereby you're allowed to rest in the race for a few days, but there is still a given day when you're expected to be ready, and you have to be ready. And a couple of times Pete Kenyuk wasn't ready when he was called upon for Team Sky, and I find it intriguing to hear him acknowledge that that's been a big issue for him, and it's something that he really wants to correct.
Chaps, should we wrap things up for this week? That was the Bora Hansgrohe episode, really, this week, but Daniel, you're off to a couple of other training camps this week, and I'm off to the Yellow Lotto in Spain this weekend as well, so maybe come back with some stuff from there next week. Shall we leave it there?
We shall, Rich. Very endearing that you ask. And yes, we should.
Just checking that you didn't have anything else. Just checking you didn't have anything else to say. Maybe just a reminder that you can now sign up as a friend for 2019. A lot of people have been asking when it'd be open. When we're open for business. Well, we're open for business now as of this week. And the Giro d'Italia diary is available for your listening pleasure. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com. We've also released this week the latest episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina, which is a long interview with Ashley Moomin-Passio, the South African rider who's moving to CCC alongside Marion Vos in 2019. Really fascinating interview with her. She's a very intelligent woman. And that was a lot of fun to visit her at her home near Banyoles, where she and her husband are setting up a cycling centre there. Lionel, we've got episode 5 of Explore this week, is that right?
Yeah, we've got the penultimate episode of the 6-part Explore series, and this one focuses on the Transatlantic Way in Ireland, which sets off from Dublin and goes up to Derry, and then follows the Wild Atlantic Way all the way down the west coast of Ireland and round the corner. And we are going to hear from Laura Scott and Simon Gill, our friend, the photographer Simon Gill, who both rode that event this year. Really compelling accounts of what it's like out on the Wild Atlantic Way.
Great. Well, that's all coming later this week. In the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you. You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube to keep up with all the latest news and special offers from us. Just search online for The Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by John Mooney.